I don't want a pickle. I just want to ride on my motorcycle. We do this live just because no one knows we do. All right, welcome. This is the Nokomoto Podcast, episode number 138. I didn't look it up. We're just going to go with that. I'm pretty sure it is. I am your host, MotoG Pete, and with me is your other host, Swiggy.
You.
Coming to you from Northern Colorado, also Nokomoto headquarters, which is also Moto One Podcast Network Studios. We had another one of our 300 Days of Sunshine that we get every year here in Northern Colorado. I think, in fact, I bet that in the next 3 weeks, we're going to experience a couple rideable days.
I think that's fair. I think that's likely.
And I've got the Goldwing ready for it, too. Which, you know, made me... I've been trying to get the president of Moto One to quit, right? So today, I took all the wheels off of his office chair. It was pretty good because, you know, he likes to just swing, you know, go back and forth in his chair behind his desk. So he sat down. You know, when people come and they sit down and like they expect the chair to just roll a little bit when they get in there, right? They kind of put their arms out like, oh, I'm going to kind of do a move. Yeah, he just fell over in the chair and it made my day. So let's see here. What is this episode going to be about? It's going to be about best worst bike. It's going to be about motorcycle lubricants and fluids and things in a how to sound like you know what you're talking about. And it's going to be about emails. And those are the things we're going to talk about. I think that's all we've got, right?
Nope.
We have a very, very important correction and omission. Maybe the most important correction and omission that we've ever done. Okay. Friends, listeners, our show has come under attack. And this aggression will not stand. Now, I'm guessing we have, like, I don't know how many listeners Creative Writing has, right? Like, maybe they've got, you know, maybe they've got 1,000 listeners, right? So by my math, there's like a 0.5% overlap between our listeners and theirs because we have so many listeners. But some might have noticed that in the latest episode of Creative Writing, I won't even say his name, the host of the show took issue with the value estimation that we put on the Air Machi Chimera, claiming that the bike was worth a mere $9,000 instead of the $120 that we put it at. Now, I am going to explain to you how I came to our thinking, right? Some people might say, hey, Pete, it seems like the host of that other show who will not be mentioned ever again by this show, by name, just the host whose name will not be mentioned, called you out on a mistake. But no, I am doubling down on my position. Haha, you expected me to apologize. If there's anything the last 4 years have taught me, never admit fault, never apologize. So here we go. Interesting facts about the Air Machi Chimera. The Air Machi Chimera, a 175, not even the 250 model, won the Pebble Beach Concours d'Elegance. Now, this is significant because this is, next to the Quail, like the most pinkies out fancy automotive event in the world, probably. This is a tuxedo sort of event. This is the kind of place where, like, butlers or people in, like, tuxedos are walking around with plates of hors d'oeuvres that cost more than your car, right? And it's very difficult to go to these things. It's sort of an invite thing. You have to sort of attach yourself to someone more important than you to go. It's not, you can't just go, I don't think. Or if you can, the tickets are stupid expensive anyway. I mean, anyway, so they fill the golf courses, these fancy golf courses, with insane rare cars, right? And okay, the Chimera fits this bill. So we're talking about a bike that was in the company of every fancy motorcycle you can conceive of, right? Like, surely someone else could have won by just bringing a Vincent Black Shadow, right? Or whatever else fancy motorcycle. So the motorcycle that it beat, the motorcycle that came in second place, was a Maserati 160. I can't remember the year. It's like some stupid old bike, though. It was from, you know, 1915 or some bullshit. It wasn't that old, but I can't remember the year. Now, and I was trying to gauge an idea of how much the Chimera must have, like, risen in value because of this. Because the last time I'd seen a value, like, I'd even bothered to look at it, was like 10 years ago or some shit. I saw that Motorcycle Classics had valued it at like 25 or 30 grand or something like that. And I did, and so I saw that it won this 2011 Concours d'Elegance. I thought, oh, that's significant. That's the sort of thing that would raise the price of a vehicle. And in trying to look up what the Maserati was worth, I did mistakenly get the value of a Maserati car. But nonetheless, I think there's a convincing argument for the Chimera being at least in that $50,000 to $60,000 range as a result, considering a lot of the bikes in the competition kind of start around that range. You know, if you want a like a Brough Superior or an Ariel Square 4, 50 grand kind of seems that starting range for, you know, ones that are candidates for restoring or something like that. Anyway, so that was where I came up with the numbers. And it's not as far-fetched as one might think. Now, let's get to the real point of this, though. As I said, we're under attack. And this aggression will not stand, okay? I am calling upon our listeners to join and fight this enemy. Okay, we will fight them. The host whose name will not be mentioned and his robotic sidekick. We will fight them on Stitcher. We will fight them on Spotify. We will defend our podcast. We will defend our position. That's right. Creative writing, I am calling a prank war. The most dangerous of all conflicts. Nuclear war? No. Far worse. Okay? Junkie. I mean, host whose name will not be mentioned. The next time you go out to your bike and your tire pressure is 5 PSI low, is it cold outside? Or is it the prank war? Right? Next time an episode doesn't load correctly? Server lag? Or prank war. Okay. I feel I've said my piece. I think everyone knows where I stand on this.
Yeah.
Okay. Now that that's out of the way. All right. So, now it's time for best worst bike, I guess.
Yeah, let's get into it.
Okay. Right. So here it is, our signature segment, the bit you've all been waiting for. This is where we each take a different motorcycle every week, alternating who has best worst bike in the world this week. And we just, you know, we make it up. Sometimes it's not entirely factually correct. And if it's not, you're just going to have to be big kids and deal with it. So, you know, if you want to give us some constructive criticism, try to correct us, or declare war on the podcast, just remember, like Evel Knievel said after he missed the landing after jumping 17 buses at Wembley Stadium, there's no crying in motorcycles. Send emails to contact at nokomotopodcast.com. Now, Swiggy, you have worst bike in the world this week.
I do.
Okay. And are you ready to reveal it?
I am.
Okay. And the worst bike in the world this week is?
The Indian Chief Dark Horse.
Oh, this is like the goth cheap version, right?
Cheap?
Well, it's the cheapest of the chieftains, isn't it?
I believe so.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, this is an interesting way to use the term cheap. Okay, walk us through.
Okay, so this is an $18,000 motorcycle. And it is basic in every way possible. So this is the 100. This is the it's got the 111-inch Thunderstroke bullshit air cooled motor,
right?
Which in and of itself is not a terrible motor, except that,
well, it's what's in the Victory Vision, just with different casings,
right? But it's also the if somebody came out of nowhere and built this on their own, or like a small boutique maker made this, it'd be super cool. But this is Indian, and
Reed Polaris.
Right. And if they didn't have so many fantastic smaller displacement liquid-cooled motors, it might be interesting. But this is purely to steal... this is purely to steal market share from Harley-Davidson, like in the most direct way possible.
Well, that is the whole point of the company. Take this name, and Polaris is trying to steal market share from Harley-Davidson. Yeah, the Harley-Davidson had 100%, for all intents and purposes, Harley-Davidson had 100% of the cruiser market. Victory made some gains. Then they thought, let's re-strategize. People aren't buying into this idea that we're creating a new heritage. They want to buy into an old one. So they kill the Victory name. They move all the technology over to Indian. So I'm not going to fault it for just being a grab at Harley-Davidson.
So actually, I will say, I do believe this motor is actually post-Victory. I want to say that this motor was specifically designed to look like an old Indian motor.
It's possible.
But the important thing here is that you can steal market share in a segment by being better. It's pretty lame to do it by emulating the company that you're trying to steal market share from. Like,
yeah, when Kawasaki did the Vulcan, what's it called? The one that looks like an Indian. The Vulcan, it's the Kawasaki Vulcan 1500 something. Oh my goodness.
Why Nomad?
No, before the Nomad. Hold on. Drifter. When they did the Vulcan Drifter, they at least had the good taste to do it whilst no one was making a bike called Indian. So in a weird way, like that, this is like a copy of a copy of a copy, and at this point it just rings pretty false.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the great things about just buying an Indian as like a 1200 or a 1 liter is it's a liquid cooled motor, and you can just be confident that it's making, you know, 60% more horsepower than any equivalent displacement Harley. Like, you have the horsepower bragging rights. You have the liquid cooling and the reliability that will go along with that, especially since all of Harley's 1200s are now super outdated motors that are unreliable as hell. Well, I won't say that. I would say they're unreliable by modern standards.
Yes.
Like, they're motors made back in the 80s.
Although they're not that bad. Supposedly the biggest problem with Harley recalls and reliability issues is every accessory just fails blindingly fast.
Well, that makes sense. So after, you know, after the you know, the Victory Octane, and then as it evolved into the Indian Scout,
which is a great bike, we have to admit, as much as we dislike the Indian branding, it's an awesome bike.
So how do you have something like the Scout, and then you make the Dark Horse, and it weighs like another 200 pounds and makes 30 less horsepower. This is an 800 pound bike that makes about 70 horsepower.
Is that all the power it makes, really?
Yep, it's a 1700 that makes 70 horsepower.
Well, I mean, that's about what towards the end of the, like, the twin cam Harleys were making, probably stock. I mean, again, it's a buttload of torque, but I mean that is enough power for these bikes, but yeah, if you're trying to beat Harley, how difficult would it be to just claim a little bit more horsepower?
Right. And now you're also selling it, you know, for $18,000.
And yeah, it's premium bike money.
And, you know, as I've said before, you know, this whole blacked out styling, it comes and goes. It's definitely, you know, a goth phase that motorcycles go through every now and then. It will not age well. But, you know, that's what guys who aspire to buy Harleys do with their Honda Shadows. This is not a premium move. But it comes like that from the factory for you.
Yeah, I guess the only thing this bike boasts is that it is simply an alternative to a Harley. That's it.
Right, but then
here's a bike that's very Americano retro styled, that's an alternative to a Harley. It's not Japanese. Here you go. That's it. That's all it has going for it. It's not more comfortable. It's not more powerful. It doesn't have better fit and finish. It doesn't have better reputation. It doesn't have better support. It doesn't have any cool engineering. It doesn't have any original design to it. It's derivative in every single way. It is just simply an alternative. That is its feature.
Yeah, and there's quite a large premium on that. I would argue not warranted.
Yeah. Yeah. Cuz at least the one that costs like, you know, 28,000, whatever the ridiculous one is, it's not called the Chieftain, it's called the something else. The one that's the full touring everything, comes with all the crazy fringe on it and has like, you know, the GPS screen and every bell and whistle. At least that's got tons of features and storage, right? Not the full bagger edition, but the full touring, mm-hmm. the full dress one. What's it called? The names are weird because everyone thinks like the chief or whatever is like the top of the line, but it's not. It's called the Roadmaster. That's what it is. The Roadmaster. That's stupid money, but it does have lots of features, at least. And some people think it's really beautiful or whatever in its own way. I personally can't stand the thing, but that's fine. I can be right or wrong about that. That's subjective, at least. I fail to see what the real attraction is to this Dark Horse. It looks like... I don't know. It looks like something somebody bought just because they, I don't even want to say it. I'm about to say something really regrettable and I don't want to say it. But yeah, I don't get the appeal. I also have a real issue with the bathtub rear fender on this bike. It doesn't look that bad in pictures, but as you know, in person, this bike is distressing.
It is a little distressing. Yeah. It's
doing this sort of Triumph 21 sort of thing with the back end, and it's not working for me. And all the big Indians do this. Like the whole back is covered up there all the way to the back.
Well, the rear, yeah, the bathtub fender, it's sort of, it's almost like as exaggerated as a scooter. It's like scooter body work. But it especially right. doesn't work on this because it's just the stripped down. It's just a stripped down from the dressed versions.
Right.
So it doesn't work stylistically. I'm going to have to stop that line there because we're getting a little too bike exif.
It's but. True. I will say something kind about it is I do like how big and thick and sort of train-like the headlight nacelle is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not especially beautiful, but at least it's sort of bold and in your face. I don't like that it's blacked out, but the overall shape of it, I think, is kind of distinctive and cool.
Yeah. I mean, if I were to sum this bike up in one word, it would be tasteless.
Yeah, the overall impression is still that. Okay. You got anything else?
I think we can move on.
Okay, let's move on to best bike in the world. And the best bike in the world this week is the 2021 Honda CRF 250 RX, which is a mouthful. Because Honda... So for non-dirt bike people... There is a class of bikes, 250 four-strokes, which are basically for motocross, and a class of 250 four-strokes, which are for trails. Why? There just are. Deal with it. It's like, why are there sport bikes and sport touring bikes? Okay? There just are, and you're going to have to deal with that. And it seems that everyone who's new... to dirt biking, as I am, has to come to this hard realization that you cannot just buy one dirt bike, which is great for everything. Because you're like, well, wait a minute. I thought there were like dirt bikes that were good for the road and you could ride off road. And those were called Enduros or Duro Sports. And then the rest were just dirt bikes, but they have different engines. Nope, it doesn't work that way. The motocross bikes have crazy suspension. They're tuned in a ridiculous way. They have close ratio gearboxes, and all of this makes them impossible to ride on trails. Well, not impossible, but extremely unpleasant. It's just not even worth doing, apparently.
So let's balance that sentiment a little bit. This is sort of like saying it's impossible to eat a steak without a steak knife.
Well, okay. Well, I've been asking people about this, and they're like, you really can't do it because how twitchy the throttles are and everything. Like, it's so taxing, it's just not worth it. Right? Like, is it possible physically? Yes. But is it going to be a good time? Is it going to be enjoyable? No. And you're going to crash a lot more and all these things, right? But, so Honda, being Honda, has been trying to pull off this magic trick for a while of sort of the dirt bike that's reasonable at both. So they've got their bikes, which, so the bike, so okay, so the sort of 250 four-stroke motocross bikes, this would be like the YZ250F, the RMZ250, whatever. Now, Honda just has an addiction to putting R's and X's in the titles of bikes, right? So it gets muddied up. Their bike that you would expect to be called the 250F, well, no, they have a bike that's called the CRF250F, and it's just a super-duper, really mild trail bike. It's got straight up half the horsepower of the CRF250R. And in fact, it's not even really a full-size dirt bike. It's sort of a 6/8 size dirt bike. It's larger than like a 125 two-stroke, but it's not a full seat height, like full-size dirt bike.
Right.
So, and it's half the price of the R as well as a result, or nearly half the price. Now the X, this is the same motor, everything. It's just got a different... So, okay, for years Honda made a CRF250X, I think starting in 2004. And this was sort of a competition trail bike kind of out of the box. So it took the CRF250R, detuned it slightly, put a different cam in it, gave it a larger fuel tank and a different suspension and all of that. And all of a sudden, here you go. Here's basically a competition trail racing bike out of the box, but it's kind of shaped and it's not terrible on a track. That's definitely not its main purpose or whatever. Now, what the RX in the last couple of years has brought to the party is this new feature that a lot of bikes are getting where you can retune the bike from your phone via Bluetooth app.
Okay.
And you can change the fueling. And so while this still has to have a wider ratio gearbox, what it basically does is it keeps the ratios fairly tight-ish, I guess, through the first four gears. And then, like, at the end, the gears just get super tall, like 4 and 5. So you can kind of do some track stuff, but it's still ultimately way better on trails. But if you want to have a go on tracks, like, this is going to be better than just a 250F, right? You know, that sort of thing. This is as close as you get as being able to buy that magic bike that does everything. Now, of course, every company has a bike that basically does this now. There's the YZ250FX, and you know, everyone's got one. But Honda, just taking care of us in the way that only Honda can, offers it for like $200 less than all the others. So yeah, this is what, if I have to buy a dirt bike new, this is what I'm getting. This is sort of the thing to have right now. Are they expensive on maintenance? Apparently yes, because the X's were, and this is fairly similar. It's just got tech updates. But you know what? Who gives a shit? They're all dirt bikes, have to constantly be rebuilt and whatever. And there are people that tell you, well, you're just better off getting an old Honda X, like a 2002 XR 400 and what. There is, as I am discovering, a world of try to reconfigure all parts, ratios, sprockets, chains, engines, suspension into the perfect bike. Everyone's got their own formula of what's perfect, and everyone disagrees with everyone in the motocross world or dirt bike world or whatever, that you're kind of just good ignoring everybody because everyone just decides what's great on their own is what it seems like. Which is, you know, also what sport bike guys do. It turns out these things are all incredibly well engineered and super tuned out of the box. Like, how much do you think you really need to alter an R6 before you take it to the track your first time? The answer is zero. The bike's better than you are, right? Out of the box, yeah.
Right.
So, but this is apparently the closest you get at a sort of beginner entry level thing. Like, this is still like 30 something horsepower. It might be like 30, 31 or something. And like the R is 35 or 40. But it's still like, it's still going to feel like a lot of power off road. Like, it's maybe not a beginner's bike, but I mean, there's not really my, I don't know. But at $8,400, it's a pretty decent value. It's as versatile as anything in this class gets. It's up to date with all the tech. And I want to say, with Honda starting to make these headlights a little bit smaller, it's one of the better lookers for a Honda dirt bike.
Well, as someone who despises the look of Honda dirt bikes, this is kind of a step in the right direction. This is a little bit more reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to dirt bikes and the looks, it's all very subtle. It's like, you know, it's like comparing the looks of a lot of different scooters. It seems like there's no difference until you start looking at a lot of them. And then you're like, oh, okay, there is quite a lot in the difference going on here. But it does. Looks don't really seem to be something that the dirt bike community is really into or cares much, you know, about. But I do, because I care how all bikes look on some level.
Well, I mean, I am still in, I'm very strongly in the category of function over form. But there is just something, there's something that is distressing about the Hondas to me. I can't entirely pinpoint what it is, but it's distressing, sort of like waking up to a fire alarm.
Okay.
I don't know what it is. It's irrational and it makes me angry. I have no justification for why, but there's something about it that I can't deal with. This is definitely the least offensive CRF that I have seen.
Yeah. Now, I want to like say it's because this thing is sort of tunable from your phone and the way the gearbox is set up that I say, like, this is the kind of bike you can do a couple circles with. Yes, you can do a couple circles on a motocross track with just about any dirt bike. But a lot of the older ones, apparently, you can't really get into the turns because of the shape of the tank. You can't really get your foot out there in the right way. And this thing is primarily a trail bike, a sort of competition trail enduro sort of bike at its heart. But it turns, just reading into it, it looks like, I said, a lot of people are looking for that magic bike that does everything. This is as close as you get. Does it actually do everything? No, don't send me angry emails. I'm saying this is about as close as you get to that. At the best value, with probably the most reliability, right?
Right.
Because it's Honda, and they've just been at this for a long time. I know Yamaha and everyone else does, because I know you dirt people rep your brands real, real hard. And that's fine. But I wish there were a couple more splashes of blue in this. But overall, like I said, I think this is a really cool looking bike. And I think this would be a good supermoto candidate as well because of the tall fifth gear. Would make it a lot more rideable on the road, I think.
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the suspension, the brakes and everything, it's all like up to standard. It's all whatever, you know. And as far as like the really, really premium race shit, well, those bikes are only like another $1,500 at most, right? Well, for the big four brands, yeah, the KTM shit and all that goes crazy and whatever. But within the big four, this seems to be like the one. If you're trail riding primarily and doing a bit of other things, this is the one to go with. And I don't know. It's kind of where I'm leaning. I'm seriously considering just buying one new because there's just fuck all on Craigslist. And I have contacted no less than four people on Facebook Marketplace this week trying to buy bikes. And just like we said, like a couple months ago, you don't have to put up anything to put something up on Facebook Marketplace. So people leave ads up after they're gone. The ads, like it seems, just never expire, which is insane. That just, you don't know. You want to buy something. You're like, there it is. There's no way to prioritize what you're going to look at. Half the, like, they don't, it's stupid. It's stupid. There's no way to know for certain where something is located. A lot of people think it's within their interest to disguise where they are.
Would you like a conspiracy theory?
Sure.
Well, this is actually very plausible. I just have no evidence for it.
Well, Facebook, that would make it a conspiracy.
Facebook is likely fake themselves publishing and faking a lot of Facebook Marketplace posts.
Oh, yeah.
To artificially create the network effect so that more people will post. Because you're gonna post to Facebook Marketplace if other people are already posting lots of stuff to Facebook Marketplace. Because you think, oh, there's a lot of business being done here. This is a good place to post. And the idea is to dial it back as authentic traffic comes in. But it's not really working. People are still
using it. Because there's just not a lot of authentic traffic.
Well, right. But it would work initially if it kicked off and accelerated very quickly. But everyone's still just using Craigslist. So they're now stuck in this trap because if all the traffic goes away all of a sudden, it's going to look really suspicious. So they have to live this lie.
Yeah, and everyone takes pictures of their bikes and has them on their Facebook profile. So they have an inexhaustible amount of pictures of bikes, which they own, because Facebook owns all your pictures that are on Facebook.
Yeah, I think
so. They can use your pictures totally legally. Yeah. It's not hard to come up with a bot to just write a bunch of nonsense about these bikes for the ad descriptions.
Yeah. And I have seen some bullshit stuff like this happen before. This is not outside the realms of what I've seen happen firsthand. Just putting it out there. I have no proof. I can't, but...
Well, in not being able to get a hold of anybody, and this is contacting not the people that are advertising the bikes for the cheapest. A lot of the people that are advertising bikes that cost more than other bikes. I'm trying to buy a good bike, not the cheapest one that I can. And no one will fucking respond. Like, no, so at this point, I am, even though it seems like there is a lot more stuff on Facebook, I was pushed to look at Facebook Marketplace because there's just fuck all on Craigslist. I'm now saying, fuck Facebook. it's not even worth it. Even though it looks better, like, no, I am 100% cutting it out now. I am just going to deal with the dog scraps that are on Craigslist.
Right.
And God help you. Like, I know there are some of you for which it has worked in the past. I think it's a horribly corrupt, broken way to do things. It's terrible. It just, no one has any skin in the game. So everyone's time gets wasted. It's bullshit. There's a lot of things listed. Like, this is common on Facebook Marketplace from what I've seen. Hey, I'm thinking about selling this. Make me an offer. Like, fuck that guy. Fuck that person. No. Is it for sale? And again, we didn't realize this until a few weeks ago. Remember we said the worst thing you can do on Craigslist is send someone a message that asks, is this still available?
Oh, yeah.
When we said that, we had no idea that the default message to send somebody is this still available?
That's the pre-populated text to message somebody on Facebook.
That alone should tell you what a horrible service this is. And if you can't figure out on your own why that's the dumbest question you can ask somebody on a classified ad, then you don't deserve to buy anything.
So this took a dark turn for a best bike in the world. Maybe we should take a break here.
Let's take a little break and come back. Okay, and we're back. So we are going to now discuss, I guess this is a tech segment. This is definitely us trying to sound like we know what we're talking about. But we're going to talk about basically any kind of fluid that you put in your bike. And basically all the bullshit surrounding that. Okay? So you could be forgiven or applauded or whatever for thinking that there is a special motorcycle version of anything wet that you put in your bike. Whether that's brake fluid, engine oil, coolant, transmission fluid, two-stroke oil, whatever. Short of gasoline, and in still some cases, people are putting in a pricier, more expensive gasoline than they really need to. There's apparently, if you walk into any dealer or even often just auto part store, a motorcycle specific fluid for all of these. And it's not necessarily that these are bullshit. But apparently the general understanding or explanation for why there are motorcycle-specific versions is wildly misunderstood.
Yeah.
So let's start with an easy one. Brake fluid. If you go into O'Reilly's or AutoZone or whatever, you will find a bottle that says motorcycle brake fluid on it. I don't know what they claim is different about it. Because, as we were saying before this, brake fluid has only two characteristics it needs to meet.
Well, by default, it has two characteristics it needs to meet, which is one, it needs to be uncompressible, and it needs to have a very high boiling point. And even then, that depends on what kind of brakes you have and what kind of brake performance you need. But ultimately, yeah, it's just those two things. And that's why your base, like, .4 brake fluid is like $4 for a supply that will last you 10 years on a bike.
Well, apparently once you crack the seal, it's only good for a couple months, they say, but whatever.
Yeah. Well.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. Now, there is the ABS fluid, the 5.1 or whatever it's freaking called. Which just needs to basically also be like non-corrosive to the seals in your ABS system. But other than not being corrosive, again, all it needs to be is non-compressible and have a really high boiling point. And that's it. I'm not aware of anything special in a motorcycle ABS system versus a car one in terms of seals or the general principle on how it works. I mean, what could possibly be variant in motorcycle disc brakes that isn't also a variant in some car brakes somewhere, right?
Yeah. I think the big thing here is that how many people... Okay, have you ever read an accident report or a news story about somebody who crashed and died because they put the wrong brake fluid in their bike or in their car?
Well, I mean, usually car accidents are not reported in that detail, right?
I mean, that is true, but...
I mean, yes, I have definitely heard of car accidents due to brake failure, although that is exceedingly rare. And if it's brake failure, it's going to be because, a seal blew out somewhere. It's not really a thing. Because considering how dumb people are and how much they mix things, what I've definitely never heard of is motorcycle brakes failing because you just used generic brake fluid versus one that had a picture of a bike on it.
Yeah. So I said this earlier. Produce
that accident report for me and I'll take back everything I've ever said.
So I said this to you earlier. A lot of this bike-specific stuff kind of has a whiff of, like, women's razors.
Right. Yeah.
put a picture of a bike on it and mark it up 30%.
Yeah.
You know?
Women's razors. It's such a perfect analogy. I forgot you said that. So good. Yeah. Exactly. Motorcycle brake fluid is women's razors, and it should not be taken seriously by anybody. So, that's an easy one. Let's talk about coolant next. So, there are a lot of people on the internet that will tell you, you can't just put coolant in your bike, man. Like, there's like chemicals and shit in there that's bad for it. You have to get the special coolant. And then they'll tell you to buy engine ice. So, Swigs, walk us through. What are people afraid of in coolant?
This is the one that you researched.
Well, I thought we both did, but silicons.
Okay, so apparently silicates will destroy seals in motorcycle radiators and pumps, but not in cars. Which may be true. But in all the research that you presented to me, there was never an explanation of, motorcycles typically use different seals than cars do for their water pumps.
Right.
There was no root cause explanation as to why this is true.
Yeah, I can't really find it. Everyone will tell you, it's the silicates, man. Like that Yeah, it's like when people talk about toxins in food. Like, dude, you can't eat that. Why? Toxins. Okay. I need something past that, right?
It's processed.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, what does that mean?
Now, I'm not saying that you can just use whatever coolant willy-nilly and it doesn't matter. I'm saying that I cannot find a decent explanation, and I would like someone to find it for us, this explanation of why you have to use coolant without silicones. Like, what specifically chemically is going on with it? Why? You can't just say, well, because. No, I need to know why. And nobody seems to know. You can Google, why is it bad for your motorcycle? Like, nothing, just a bunch of people talking in circles. Well, why is it bad? Well, because these people said it was bad. Why did they say it was bad? Just because. Is it just to sell more expensive coolant, right? I mean, scientifically, nothing cools better than water.
But unlike, but it's not Brondo.
Right.
Which has electrolytes.
It's what plants need, right? Yeah, so I mean, that's the coolant thing. I other than that, I mean, and here's the other crazy thing too. If you go at least at Ace Hardware and look at the coolants, you can find one that's silicon free. Like, you don't have to buy special motorcycle coolant even then. There is one that doesn't have it that's generic on the rack. Like, you still don't have to buy one with a picture of a bike on it that costs 30% more.
Well, turns yeah. out. I mean, the two-stroke oil I put into the scooter had a picture of a jet ski on it.
Dude. You are playing with fire. You used jet ski oil. Yeah, exactly. Is there something special about jet ski two-stroke motor? That can't take it.
In summary, I would say it would be nice if we could make, like, decisions based on, you know, root causes and principles rather than this weird sort of telephone game we play with people that may or may not know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we largely don't know what we're talking about.
But yeah, but apparently if you go onto a forum, you're not allowed to even ask the question.
Okay.
Because the group is rewarded for shouting you out of the room.
Yeah, there's two things here. One is, yes, like, we should have, like, we should not be relying on these flippant, like, weird explanations of, like, oh, it's the silicates, or other nonsense that we hear all the time, like, oh, it's the friction modifiers. Like, that one line explanation is insufficient to make a real informed decision. Now, when it comes to things like internet forums, and I think there was a form of this that happened in a lot of shops, particularly on the sales side, this happens a lot. And it's now been amplified immensely, like by orders of magnitude, by the internet. And this is just a little bit of this is an impromptu Swiggy's guide to life and living in a modern world and understanding how we're all hopelessly lost. There is a phenomena that occurs with every internet community that gets large enough, which is this concept of positive feedback culture. Ultimately, anytime you get an internet group, anytime there's some way to quantize approval or popularity, what inevitably happens, and this is the same thing that's happened forever on, like, you know, the music charts, is somebody finds something popular, they get a reward for it, and now everyone sees what was popular and how they were rewarded, whether that's money, emotional validation, you know, notoriety, anything like that. And then people begin to chase that. And they do it over and over and over again. And it gets more and more extreme. And this happens with, like, this happens with sense-making, too. Until people are saying insane things like, somebody didn't use their turn signal. That person deserves the death sentence. Like, it gets out of control really fast, and it happens everywhere all the time. And this is kind of happened a lot with a lot of online motorcycle culture, especially now that, well, especially during COVID when nobody's actually talking in person, nobody's actually interacting with people in person who know what they're talking about. Yeah. I just wanted to put that out there.
Okay, so let's move to the granddaddy of all these issues, which is motorcycle engine oil. Okay, just your regular engine, what you just dump into that crankcase. So, the big bad demon that is in engine oil for cars are friction modifiers. So the conventional wisdom, supposedly, is that you can't use car oil in a motorcycle because the friction modifiers will cause your clutch to slip. And then a lot of other people have then concluded that that will ruin your transmission. As we apparently Bike Bandit thinks it will ruin your transmission. We found an article stating that you risk damaging your transmission by using oil with friction modifiers. This is insane.
But what transmission is friction based?
Exactly. I know. But you read the article with me. This was on Bike Bandit as they were recommending oils to buy, right? This is insane. So the idea is that apparently no other part of your engine but your clutch will be affected by these friction modifiers. Now, they never explain what friction modifiers are, how they work, why they're needed, what they're doing. So
yes, because the person who wrote that was a journalist and not a mechanic,
right?
Or an actual automotive engineer with a PhD and a research paper or any sort of actual first-hand experience that would validate this claim.
Well, it's also a person with just apparently an extreme lack of curiosity. So I looked up, how do friction modifiers work? Which is apparently a question that only nerds have asked. And I found a very, very good answer at machinerylubrication.com. I encourage everyone to go to machinerylubrication.com and look up friction modifiers, because there are actually many articles on friction modifiers there, how they work, what they're used for. And going through this, I don't see a convincing argument that these friction modifiers bond to the materials in your clutch pack, like, at all. So, engine oil coats everything it comes in contact with. It will drip off whatever, but it's constantly being pumped around. And it creates a layer that metal essentially glides on. So it's never truly making contact, right? And motorcycles still tend to use kind of heavy oils as compared to cars, right? Because of the efficiency and the, you know, the miles per gallon and everything that we require out of cars now, these oils are getting very, very light.
Well, yeah, like most compact cars today are using like 535 and 530.
Mine's like 040.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's nuts. Like they're like down to zero. Like it's, yeah. Yeah. So in a situation where you either have extreme pressure coming between two pieces of metal or like the oil itself just can't do it, they put in these friction modifiers. And what it is, it's a string of molecules with a polarized end. And that essentially sticks to the metal surface. You can think of them as like a bunch of strands of carpet. They're all like connected at one end, right? And they're kind of, you know, kind of fuzzy and whatever. And they bond to both sides of these pieces of metal coming together. And just like you can kind of like wave your hand over the carpet and kind of make it level in a spot, right? The oil-soluble tail of these strands is it's sacrificial. It'll wear away. So it gets into the tiny little crevices of the metal and just makes it more smooth. But more importantly, it's a sacrificial barrier. So it's not just oil that the metal is gliding on. The metal actually gets coated in this material. Now, your clutch isn't made of metal. It's resin, it's ceramic or whatever. It's not really obvious to me that these friction modifiers will be bonding to the clutch. But if they are, machinerylubrication.com informs us that often these friction modifiers are made in such a way that they will have a slight effect on clutches, in that they will make them slightly less grabby and operate a little bit smoother by providing just a tiny bit of not lubrication, but what's the word? There's a really great word. I got to find it in this article again. But anyway, it can, in fact, have an effect, even though it seems counterintuitive, make your clutch work a little bit smoother. So I doubt you would want to do this in, say, a racing situation, but it looks like under just normal road conditions, there might even be just the tiniest benefit to your clutch performance from these friction modifiers, as indicated by this article I'm reading. And I'm going to be honest, I know that there are just hundreds of thousands of dudes out there pouring regular engine oil in, and I've never gone like and like bought a Craigslist bike or something and been like, "Oh, this clutch is slipping. You've been using car oil, haven't you?" Right? Like, I mean, I've just never seen it. I've never seen a clutch slipping because someone's using car oil. I've never come across it in the wild.
Okay, if you run like a motorcycle YouTube channel, like if you're like a dealer with a YouTube channel who does all sorts of zany content, if you could just take 4 grams and just put like the standard Honda oil in one, the 1040 brand of O'Reilly's oil, and then another bike with Rotella, and then some crazy high performance oil, and then get some actual, like an actual, like semi-professional or like a club racer to ride all of them and see if he can identify which is which. I'd be very interested to see what the results of that were.
Yeah. I'm not saying that there's, it's not beneficial to use motorcycle oil in your motorcycle versus just regular oil for a car or whatever else.
But is it actually a disaster?
Right. Is it a big deal?
Right.
I think the evidence points that it's probably not. Like, actually learning how these friction modifiers work, I don't understand how it could be that disastrous. Because, again, another part of this is, like, under enough pressure, like, they will just wear away. It's a sacrificial layer. The whole point of them is that under pressure, they'll kind of shave themselves off. They'll bond and then shave off and bond and shave off. That's the whole point. So I don't see how it could permanently damage your clutch and all that. And again, because it wears away and it's your clutch, not just two smooth metal surfaces. I just don't see it, you know? And also, these things come into play when the tolerances are really crazy and the pressure's high enough that regular oil can't do the job. And because motorcycle oil is thicker than a lot of car oils these days, it's likely that your oil is thick enough that these friction modifiers don't really even come into play.
I guess, if there's enough inertia. Well, actually, I don't think it's.
And if you're really that concerned about it, buy a Ducati with a dry clutch.
Well, it's probably more important if you have a dry clutch, because of the fact that with the clutch out of the equation, the engines are more tuned for a specific oil.
Yeah, that was the other point. I would say it's way more important to make sure you have the right weight oil than one with or without friction modifiers.
Yes. Well, again, just a reminder, we may or may not know what we're talking about. This could be completely wild and off, but the sense here is that this is...
Blown out of proportion.
This is majorly overplayed.
Right. Does it have an effect? Probably. But is it, like, under normal road conditions detectable? I bet it's not.
Yeah, and the question I have, and I think that I proposed this to you earlier, is let's say you put car oil into your motorcycle.
I used to do with the Ninja.
Let's say you have, like a CB500R, and you put car oil into it and you do the normal maintenance, but you put car oil in every time. Are you wearing your clutch 300% faster, 500% faster, or is it 50% faster, 10% faster, no faster at all? What is the actual cost of this maneuver? What are the results? Because, you know, in every place that it matters, we have detailed consumer reports on this all over the place. I've yet to come across any sort of consumer report about any particular oil with any kind of standardized test in any way whatsoever that demonstrates what this is. Like, what happens? Now, again, if you just put Rotella in your motorcycle, I'm sure there are some costs.
There may or may not be.
What percentage of wear off of normal is it? Does somebody jump on a Ninja that's 10 years old and they realize, this clutch wore out 1,000 miles before it should have? Some bastard put car 1040 in it. What an asshole. Like, what is the resolution of
let's say, okay, you do have to replace all the clutch plates after 50,000 miles prematurely or something. What is the cost of those anywhere from $100 to $300 versus how many oil changes and how much extra you paid for the more expensive oil? What is the difference?
When we're also not talking about you ruin the clutch, so it's the whole cost of a brand new clutch. It's like maybe the clutch wore 20% faster. Like, It's a fifth of a clutch.
It's definitely not affecting the springs. Like, it's just the plates.
So, I mean, the question is, like, on balance, like, if you're spending, like, $70 in oil change, which...
If you're a Moto Guzzi owner, that's definitely not out of the question. But for us Honda owners, this is something that can be accomplished a lot cheaper.
Yeah, but yeah, especially like on a Honda, it's like when you get to the when you've done your like six oil changes and then you have to replace the clutch. Like if you're saving $40 per oil change on a large-ish motor, like, and you look, you think about how much earlier
that's
you'll
assuming
have
to, you do have to do that change after six oil. That's only like let's say 5,000 miles on an oil. Well, now I bet a lot of bikes are now more like 8,000. So 40. No one's replacing clutches at 40,000 miles,
right? So as long as there's no actual detectable clutch slipping, it doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Unless you want to really preserve the clutch on your like 1986 Goldwing that's done 60,000 miles 40 years later, and now this bike that's worth $2,200 maximum. It's like, oh, well, you know, we got to replace the clutch now. Like, at what point, like, after a certain point of vehicle depreciation, like, this all becomes moot anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. yeah, exactly. We're not saying it's not a thing. We're saying it's probably not that big of a thing to really worry about. Probably. I mean, do I still use the oil, like the Honda oil? I do, because the manual says use the manufacturer recommended oil. And if you go into, you know, if you look it up from Honda, they'll tell you, okay, so it's the GN4 or whatever oil, right? So I just use manufacturer recommended oil, but I'm not like buying AMS oil or like what the fuck ever. Like what I'm buying is a few dollars more. The Honda stuff isn't all that crazy. Like the Yama Lube's really fucking expensive, and the Motul and all that crap. I don't know who fucking has the money for that bullshit. But yeah, on the Ninja, I would just put it, you know, on the Ninja, I never had issues with anything. I put plenty of miles on that bike, and you know what I put in it? I didn't even put in like Valvoline. I used the O'Reilly store brand oil. And there were never any issues. The clutch didn't slip. That's what I'm saying. And yeah, if you've got a vintage bike, I bet it like really doesn't fucking matter, because all the tolerances are so huge and everything anyway. All that really matters is you vaguely got the right weight oil in there, right? Which is probably why a lot of people do get away with the Rotella thing. I bet an old bike, it really doesn't fucking matter. But
I mean, you know what? It doesn't matter what you publish as your specifications. It doesn't matter how much you, like, it doesn't matter how vigilant you are with informing people of what, how they should handle your product and how they should maintain it. Ultimately, people are going to fuck it up, and people are going to do things against what you specify, and then they're going to destroy it, and then they're going to get mad at you, and in the world, you know, in public opinion, in that insane world, it's still going to be your fault. And everybody's found this out one way or another over and over and over again. You cannot produce a 1550 weight oil specced motor and have it commit seppuku when 1040 is put into it. Like it has to survive. Like it may run shitty, It may overheat. It may wear faster. But, like, you can't have a Ducati that can't accept 1040 and throw a rod or, you know, crack a valve cover. Like, it has to survive. There is a level of tolerance built into every motor out of necessity.
Well, the other thing is, you know, with all these motorcycle-specific fluids, part of what you're paying for is just a sort of false peace of mind. To be like, oh, did I put the right thing in? Well, it's got a picture. So I feel good about putting it in, right? And to a certain degree, every decision you make with putting a fluid in a bike comes to that. It's like, what is, under the current formulation of oils, what you're supposed to put into a 100-year-old motorcycle, right? Because oil today in no way resembles whatever oil was around 100 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is no manufactured recommended replacement oil for that anymore. There just isn't. So you have to sort of figure out what the best oil to put in it is. Like the splines on the final drive of the Goldwing are an amazing example of this. So there was a specific Honda moly paste that was supposed to be used on the spline. So every time you replace the tire, the back wheel's got to come off and everything. You're supposed to clean off all the paste and replace it. Otherwise, you'll get premature wear on the drive shaft splines, which is a real thing, very well documented. If you don't do that on your Goldwing or any Honda shaft drive bike, you're going to screw it up. So Honda discontinued the specific product that you're supposed to grease that with or paste it with, whatever. And there's another very similar product that some people claim is the Honda replacement for the old product. And some people on forums claim is, no, that's just simply another one. And someone just started this vicious rumor that that's the replacement paste that you're supposed to use. And people are looking up the composition of this and going, no, it's only 20% this instead of 80% like the old one was, and blah, 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 blah. And there's theories and name calling going back and forth. Prank wars have been instigated and all sorts of things. And now... Like, it's sort of like put on there whatever makes you feel good is kind of where a lot of people are at. You can find all kinds of things that people are like, yeah, I put this on there and anyone that uses anything else is an idiot, right? And all of their bikes seem to be working, right?
Yeah, it
maybe the more important thing is that you're just changing these fluids at all. It seems to me that most people that just do regular fluid changes on their bikes tend to just have better running bikes in general, regardless of what it is they're putting in there.
Yeah. It's actually doing maintenance. It turns out if you're just doing maintenance at approximately manufacturer specified intervals, you're doing really good.
Yeah, I think comes to the silica, when it comes to the friction modifiers, when it comes to the brake fluid, when it comes to the whatever, you know, the shaft fluid, like whatever it is, right? The gear oil, whatever. There's things that people throw around. People just hear, oh, well, I heard you have to use the thing without this. And then when I talk, because everybody wants to sound like they know what they're talking about. So a lot of people repeat these things. And it's not that there's no truth to them, but they get repeated as gospel, and no one really seems to fully understand the underlying principle behind why they were even arguments for using or not using products in the first place. You can't just say, oh, friction modifiers, they fuck up your clutch. the how. You need to explain how.
Dark energy.
Dark energy, exactly.
It's like, look, if you're not lubricating your chain in bear semen, you're a fucking idiot.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another one. Fucking chain lube. We didn't even get to that. That's a whole nother thing. Should you be using wax? No, it's got to be lube. Can you use WD-40? Can you use used engine oil? It turns out you can use pretty much fucking anything as long as you're doing it a lot and cleaning your chain.
Yeah.
There, I have heard of a lot of people that are like, look, after every ride, I brush off the chain and I wipe it with old engine oil. And they claim to get amazing life out of the chain.
Well, even then, chains aren't insanely expensive. Like,
right? Yeah. Well, there are some pricey ones, but yeah.
It is a consumable product. Like, it is...
It's a wear maintenance item. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think
the moral to take away from this is let's all just be a little less opinionated. Like,
let's do the math. The moral is a lot of people on forums are full of shit. Calm down and just do your maintenance and it'll be fine.
Yeah. I think that's the right way to go.
And also, you know, I wonder, after being called out on possibly making an inaccurate statement, could this segment have been a little bit of baiting for people? Okay, cool. Let's put in a break and then come back with emails. All right, we're back. We took a little bit of a break. Swig's put down a few more beers, so I think he's ready to read the emails drunk. Swiggy, are you ready to read the emails?
I hope so.
Okay. So, what's our first one here?
So, we've got an ensemble of dirt bike responses.
Yes, which is good. That's what we asked for. Results.
Good stuff. So we have one from My Motorbike Obsessions, and he says, Pete, listening to your latest podcast with talk about dirt bikes was weirdly timely. I've been thinking about getting back into off-road a lot recently. Here are some thoughts. A good 4-stroke 250/300 class bike will work just fine and won't be something you outgrow too soon. Most of the Japanese 450s are motocross bikes and really are quite the handful. They're made for short bursts of high power and have stiff chassis to survive jumping. My 2006 CRF 450R came with 55 horsepower stock. There's way too much power for my use case on the dirt. I got mine set up for flat track, and I should have started with a 125 or a 250 for that kind of racing. A 250/300 is great all around. Is a great all-around bike for trail riding and motocross parks. There are lots of options. SSR has some. All the Japanese have something in that size. There is a new Chinese company with a good reputation called GPX. They have 2- and 4-stroke models, and the guy that imports them is out of Utah, and from what I have seen, is very interested in making a good bike and not just selling rebadged crap. The 2-strokes are really made for enduro or woods racing and seem to require a lot of fiddling. I am interested in that kind of riding and in getting a decent 2-stroke, but I wouldn't try it for a new rider. Are you wanting a dual sport or a pure dirt bike? They deliver power differently, with the dual sports being very soft in the smaller CC range. Weight does become a factor depending on your riding type. A good 250/300 is good size for tighter terrain. A 450 is great for more open stuff like desert riding. A 450 also makes a great supermoto. I bought a set of sumo rims for my CRF and can change between flat track and sumo in 2 hours for a nice multi-purpose bike. Next, I want to get an OEM fork set and shock with some motocross wheels for a true do-it-all bike. Just like street riding, what do you want to do and find what fits for your wallet? Happy hunting.
So I'm kind of down to three different options here right now. If I can find a reasonably priced, as in not only a few years old and three quarters of its original price, CRF 250X, you know, for $2,800 I'll jump on that. It's looking like those don't exist because everyone that I've seen on Facebook, no one responds. As far as something new, then, besides finding that bike used, there really doesn't seem to be much else, because like the YZ250F is kind of more of a motocross bike than a trail bike, I guess. I don't know. It's just all these bikes, but what kind of seems to fit the bill of something that will do mostly trails and some track, but like a real dirt bike, not an enduro, not a dual sport, right? Is that CRF 250RX, or weirdly also just because you can, the SR300S, which is the SSR 300 dirt bike, which has roughly kind of 250F kind of power and characteristics. Because, and here's the reason I kind of need something a little bit sort of, what is it? It's flexible. Yeah, I want to like ride trails. I'm not going to be a competition motocross racer. But, you know, the advantage of something that's kind of a little bit loosey-goosey is, yeah, I want to go ride trails with Leica. But then what if the boy's not into it? Is he just going to sit in the car while we do that? Right? It would be nice to be able to go to the track, and if he's not into it, he can just sit there and watch or something. But it kind of presents a parenting problem if I can't have both the kids involved at once to go and do trails. It just right. does.
Well, and also, I mean, let's look at it from this perspective. Like, you know, if you play guitar, occasionally you might want to play bass. Or if you're just somebody who wants to get into playing bass, the entry point for getting into bass is not $6,000. It's like $120 for a kit that will get you a playable bass with an amp and everything all good to go. Is it a great bass? No. It's kind of shitty. But is it 90% of the way there? Yes. What is the actual entry level point? Just to be able to enjoy it without going, without being a professional rider, without making this your full-time passion, what is the real bang for buck entry level option?
Well, it seems to be the SR300S, because if you're going to compare, like, let's compare the SR300S to a CRF250F, right? The CRF250F isn't really full size, right? So it's kind of just feels a lot less cool because of that right off the bat, you know? Only a total pussy would ride one, apparently. Right. So the SR300S, you know, kind of looks the part one. But also, It's got a little bit more power. It's not premium components, you know, whatever, but it's also slightly cheaper. But if you're not in a sort of competitive mode, reports are it's approachable. It's a decent beginner bike. It's not really specifically for racing or whatever. It's just kind of a Chinese dirt bike. And I, you know, it's only $4,500. Like, if it's not that precious, you can kind of just fuck it up and do whatever to it. Like, who gives a shit?
Yeah. So dirt bikes are one area. Like, I've found people who, you know, like, I know salespeople who buy like R6s and spec them out and put all sorts of money. And I've never found like a casual R6 owner. Even, and in a more extreme way, I've never ever found anybody who was a dirt bike owner who was not an extremist. Like,
yeah,
it goes hardcore. I don't know why. Especially considering like how accessible it should be in the US. Like, is there any other place that has like more accessible like off-road riding? I would expect it to be more of a generalist thing and just like a lot more laid back, but apparently not.
Yeah, I mean, as far as what I want a bike to specialize in and zero in on that special thing, it's probably ultimately going to be more off-road and trail because, well, there's only so many tracks and things around, and here in Colorado, there are quite a lot of trails. So yeah. Ultimately, that's where it's all going to go because why not? There's more variety there. It's a pain in the ass to get to some of them. You got to drive quite a ways, but hey, that's a full day out, you know?
Yeah. So what's the bike for somebody who doesn't know what they want to do?
I think it's the SR300S probably, but I also just, I mean, I love Honda. So, yeah, but yeah, I'm not getting a full-on motocross bike. That's dumb because that you can't really do as much as. There's no law that says you can't just take a general kind of purpose off-road dirt bike and you can't just whip around and do some light jumps and this and that whatever. There's no, you know, like yeah, you can do a road trip on a Hayabusa. It's fine. The police aren't going to pull you over. Like, excuse me, sir, you are three states away from where this bike is registered. Like, that doesn't happen, right?
Right.
I mean, it kind of does the other way. You can't really take the motocross bike and go on the trails. Like they said, they're too twitchy. But anyway, next email.
All right. Next email is from Eric. And Eric says, "Dear MotoGP, a four-stroke, mild, non-motocross 250 is absolutely the way to go. Yamaha WR250, Honda CRF250 are both good machines. Both are fuel-injected if you like this. The WR has more power and better suspension. The Honda's cheaper. Kawasaki makes a nice 250-class machine as well, although I'm not as familiar with this bike. 250s are light enough to not wear you out when you drop them constantly, it will happen, while still having enough power to keep you entertained long enough to not outgrow it. If you're okay with carburetors, other options are available. I'm a DRZ400 fan, but I'm also a big guy, 6'2", 260, and don't mind the extra weight. I'm also someone who likes to ride to the trails, not load my machine into a truck. So my calculations are likely different than yours. Stay away from the RM250 if you don't want to deal with race bike maintenance intervals. Stay far away from Euro bikes if you don't want to constantly work on your machine as well. If you don't believe me, look at the maintenance schedule for any motocross 450 to see what I mean. Most KTMs, GasGas, Beta, etc. have similar issues. They're great bikes for the right riders, but that's not the beginning dirt bike rider who wants to do a bit of trail riding. Having ridden two strokes or various sizes over a long time, I'll say that most two strokes sold in the US since the 1980s have been designed and tuned for explosive top end power bands. This makes them hard to ride for inexperienced dirt riders. They're perfect motocross machines, terrible trail bikes for most riders. You want tractable, low-end power, excellent carburation, low throttle openings, and a suspension that can soak up bumps, holes, roots, etc. I hope this helps. Dirt riding is awesome. Go easy at first and enjoy the ride.
Yeah, so this is all figured into my thinking and the bikes that I'm thinking about. As far as the foreign bikes go, fuck that for a first bike. Matt from My Motorbike Obsessions had a follow up email where he sent me a link to a YouTube channel of this guy that just buys piece of crap bikes and just abuses them and races them and whatever. It's called Torture Test Magazine. It's really good. I recommend it. And I was watching this video just today, and he goes, "This is a message to all those DR 200 riders out there that are thinking of downgrading to a KTM 200. Don't do it." And it's one of those things. It's like sport bikes. It's really more, it seems that it's really a lot more about your skill level than anything else. I'm not fretting over buying the perfect bike. I just don't want to buy something that's really ill-advised.
Yeah, like, this is another element of internet culture, is that, like, everybody has to be an expert and everybody has to dial in on exactly the right thing. You know, people have run marathons in steel-toed boots. Like, it's okay. Nothing, like, the equipment does not have to be this perfect alignment. And I think it's good to, you know, be in the right ballpark. I'm not personally looking forward to running a marathon in steel-toed boots. But I realize that it can be done.
We did do an iron butt on a ZX6 Ninja and a W650.
That's true.
As Emma said, bold choices. So, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's right to, it's better to be in the right ballpark and to have something close to it. But I don't think that, like, this super fine tuning is necessary.
Well, we're going to see, right? I mean, one thing that's really fun about this is, you know, I haven't even bought a bike yet, and I'm already sort of in uncharted territory, right? So it's kind of like with the scooters. This is a whole different dimension to jump into that I don't really know about yet. I'm just finding out about it. So, cool. What else we got?
We got another email from Adrian. And Adrian says, "G'day from Australia. Just a quick tip. More alcohol consumption will definitely improve fluency in reading emails from listeners. Often find myself trying to mentally prompt the next word while listening without even seeing the text in front of me. Keep up the great work, and I love the insight and humor." Okay. I can relate to this.
All right, listen. I have a tip for Adrian, which is, don't send podcast emails from your work email. Reading a few words from the little tag that was auto-generated by your work email, your full name, which you included because it's your work email, and a general guess from our download statistics, I was able to narrow you down to one of two people in seconds. And then after I actually checked your full email address, found out, just for funsies, where you live, relatives' names, whatever, Google Street View, and I could probably could have found, like, your license plate number as well. You're really lucky we're not evil people. So,
I guess it's been
don't
like
do that.
I guess it's been like 120 episodes since I've given that advice. After what's his name who sent us, who got, like, really high on pills, like on OxyContin. And
Soren.
Oh, Soren. Yeah, who sent us his...
He sent us his bike injury x-rays. We need to dig those up and get those printed.
Well, we'll crop the personal information.
Well, yeah. But yeah, Adria, I know what you look like. I know where you live. I know all the. I could. Your identity was almost as good as stolen. I got this email at like 3 a.m. our time, and I couldn't sleep. And I was like, let me just see how long this takes from my phone. And it was not long. Okay. It was not long.
All right.
But yeah. Yeah. Of course we're good. Of course drinking. Of course. All right. Next email.
All right. So we've got, this is my favorite alias, Jet Ski.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Says, bro, listening to 137 podcast, and I'm not sure the SSR is the way to go. It's just a pit bike and will probably be too big for your daughter. I think you would have more luck with a TTR90/110. Or a KX110, and it will fit better than an SSR or a Pitster Pro.
Okay, I'm open to that. I've yet to actually, get ultimately the decision on what bike for her will be sort of based on taking her physically to a bike in a dealership and seeing what she kind of fits on, right? But I was thinking the SSR 70 because, well, price does factor in because this bike will be outgrown pretty quickly. And I thought, how much performance does it really need? She just really needs to sort of figure out some principles of riding a bike off-road. That's it. And then the thing will be sold and that money will roll into the next bike. That's just how this works. And I also found some videos of kids that looked very much her size, riding them around competently, doing beginner kid riding things. So I thought, why not? I don't need this to be competitive with other kids' bikes. So that was the reason. If these other bikes fit her better, then sure, why not? But for twice, three times the price, I don't know. We'll see. I'm taking your advice, but like, it's ultimately just going to be what bike she fits on best. And I don't know that it's going to be a new bike, but it's also really hard to find used bikes. Reasonable priced SSRs brand new are plentiful. I don't know. That's just going to be something that's figured out in person. I don't know. But heard. Okay. And, oh, there's one last email. So we get less and less of these all the time, but this is from Jeff in Sweden. And he found the secret password from early episodes. And I was drunk. Okay. I thought there was a good chance no one was ever going to hear this podcast at the time. Some interesting facts. There's almost 900,000 active podcasts on Apple. Who knows what the number is if you combine it across Spotify and Stitcher and all the different platforms. There's probably a million active podcasts. It's estimated that these days, the average number of downloads across all podcasts is like 117 per episode. Now, we are way beyond that. We are probably more popular than about, I'm going to guess, at least 800,000 of those million podcasts, right? I cannot just start sending stickers to Sweden and mailing them out to everyone that finds this. So I have to call an end to the secret word. It was also
more than 2 years ago.
Well, I probably said I don't give a shit if it was 5 years into the future. I probably
there were some bold promises, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyone that does send the email, like, you know, and all that, I we still recognize you as a proper fan of the show to go through and listen to everything, and we commend you. You are a true Noco Loco, and we salute you and appreciate you taking the time to listen to our stupid show. So thank you, Jeff. And send us a follow-up email with what the motorcycle situation in Sweden is. You know, how long's the riding season? What type of bikes are most prevalent? I know nothing about Swedish bike culture. I'm gonna guess there's some, it's like, it makes, it being Sweden, I'm gonna guess it makes, oh no, Switzerland's the one where, like, you can't have, like, anything more powerful than, like, a 300 or something, right?
I have no idea.
I want to say Switzerland has, like, amazingly oppressive bike laws.
That sounds weird.
I know, but I thought for sure I saw some sort of, like, documentary where, like, there was, like, a Harley club, but they had to have all the engines swapped out for, like, 250 V-twins because it was just, they just really, you can't have anything super powerful for bikes.
This sounds like a hallucination.
It probably was. This is a weird time in my life.
This sounds weird. I don't know. I'm skeptical.
All right. Anyway, what's Swedish bike culture like? We want to know. Okay, I think that wraps it up. Mm-hmm. We're just barely going to get in under the wire under an hour and 50 minutes, it looks like, which is not a bad time. So, tell a friend about the show. Leave ratings and reviews wherever possible, please. Let us know what's going on in your bike life. Hey, don't stop with the dirt advice because I'm still an idiot when it comes to this shit. We'll be back next week with another episode, and who knows what the hell. Remember, we have an official prank war with Creative Riding and the host who will not be named. The gauntlet is thrown. The aggression, we will not stand for this aggression. It will not stand. At full on war. Okay? So, I've been your host, MotoGP. He's been your host, Swiggy. And we're going to sign out on this one. Stay safe, stay tuned. Keep fighting the dragon.
And I don't want to die. Just want to ride on my motorcycle. Cold.
Creative Riding's going down.